Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lickin' on Lending, the weekly mortgage market update, providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lickin' on Lending, David Lickin.
Hello, everyone. This is Alice Alvey filling in for Dave Lickin today. Dave is on an airplane coming back from Seattle from having a trip with his family over the holiday weekend. We hope all of you had a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend. It sure is great having 4 days off, but now we're trying to get back into the swing of things here and get through our getting that energy back into paying attention to mortgages after eating all that turkey. So on today's program, we are very happy to have Glenn Corso and Pete Mills joining us from the Community Mortgage Banking Project. They will be with us later in the program, so stay tuned for that. First off, as we do always at the beginning of the show, we need to get our brains around rates and what's going on in the market. So we have Joe Farr from MBS Quote Line. Joe?
Hi, Alice.
What's going on?
Well, today's been a little volatile in a good way. We started out low this morning as the stock market futures opened up big. Overseas markets were up big, and we were down about 10-30 seconds this morning when most people would have priced. And we've made it all the way back to unchanged from end of last week, from end of last Friday. So, and that's without a big turnaround in the stocks. Even though the Dow was up over 300 earlier today, it's still up 280 now. So, this has been a nice improvement in MBS prices. And if you haven't already, look for a favorable price change in your price sheets today, because it's very likely.
All right, that's always good.
Yeah. Good way to start the week, huh?
Right.
Most of what happened to begin the day and much of what's happening to the stock market has to do with a couple things. One is good over-the-weekend retail sales numbers. Black Friday and throughout the weekend, I think retail sales exceeded expectations, and that's favorable for the stock market. And then also, news out of Europe was favorable, and two things have come out of Europe over the weekend. One was the report of a possible deal with IMF, or the International Monetary Fund, I didn't say that right, will provide aid to Italy, and also hope that Germany and France are going to be successful. They're trying to build a pact where the various entities in the European community will be expected to manage their fiscal issues in a certain way that's different than it is now, obviously, and both those things were viewed as positive for stocks and not positive for mortgage prices this morning. Now, notice that both of those are like reports of a possible deal. And
right,
hopes
right.
for a pact. I mean, it's all very, very tentative at this point.
Yeah, soft. Well, you know, we've had our hopes raised before to have them changed.
Right.
So it seems to be a minute-by-minute scenario, but still at least landing on a good note right now.
Right. And one other piece of news came out this morning. I don't know if it's official yet, but we're told Barney Frank he's not going to seek re-election. So I'll be interested to hear Glenn's perspective on that.
Yeah. We're sticking. He's left his legacy, though, for all of us.
Sure has.
That's for sure. So, all right. So, what's going on? Last week, what did we? What do you want to tell us about last week? And then,
well, it was short week. You know, we had we were off Thursday, and Friday was a short day, an early close. For the week, mortgage rates were a little higher, which is going to be different than what your customers read about. From Freddie Mac. You know, Freddie Mac puts out their
right.
weekly survey, and Freddie Mac's survey is predicated on information Monday to Monday, basically, or Monday and Tuesday to Monday and Tuesday. And so the drop in prices we saw late in the week, last week, especially on Friday, caused there to be a net change for the week of having rates a little higher. So be able to explain that to your customers, because it is all about timing.
Okay.
And during the week, last week, Treasury auctions were strong. which was good to see, and economic data was pretty much close to expectations, although the third quarter GDP was revised a good bit lower from 2.5 to 2. Core PCE was inflation index was very tame at 1.7%.
Okay, so we can handle that. How about looking forward?
This week we will continue to see shifts in what's going on in Europe, and that will continue to move MBS prices in the stock. We're going to continue that for a long time, I believe. The big event this week, is as every month, is the jobs report. It comes out on Friday at 8:30. There's an expectation for 125,000 job growth. Then the other bigger events are the Chicago PMI comes out on Wednesday and the ISM index comes out on Thursday. So biggest thing always each month is the jobs report.
Right, right, and being able to make sure that we get that growth that everyone's expecting. So, but volatility is the nature of the game, it seems, these days.
Sure is.
So, well, thanks, Joe, for that great wealth of information. We look forward to it every single week. I know that you're going to be very involved in this program as we go forward when we have Glenn Corso and Pete Mills talking about the future of the independent mortgage banker. We're going to be covering the GSE minimum servicing fees and all kinds of, you know, QRM, you name it, lots of great topics to talk about, things that are impacting the independent mortgage banker, and we'll definitely need your feedback as we go through those segments as well. But thank you for our market update today.
Sure.
So. All right. Well, we'll be right back after this brief break.
Economic uncertainty has created a tremendous amount of market volatility for the past few weeks. Intraday price changes seem the rule rather than the exception. Have you been surprised by a midday price change? Have you been frustrated as you locked the loan just ahead of a price movement? Found it difficult to explain to a customer why the rate you quoted is no longer available? MBS Quoteline can eliminate these frustrations. MBS Quoteline monitors Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae mortgage-backed security prices in real time. It makes the information conveniently available on your desktop, smartphone, or by email or text message. These are the same prices used to set mortgage rates each morning and to issue midday price changes when significant movement occurs. With MBS Quoteline, you'll never be out of touch with the market,
whether you're in the office or on the road.
See for yourself what MBS Quoteline can do for you. Go to MBSQuoteline.com to start a risk-free two-week trial.
MBSQuoteline.com.
646-716-4972. The Lickin' on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lickin.
Hello, everyone. Alice Albee again here filling in for Dave. We are back now to talk about the legislative update, but make sure you stick around for Glenn Corso and Pete Mills as we're going to be discussing that future of independent mortgage banking. For now, I'm going to give you the legislative update, two proposed rules that we're watching that are still open for comment, and one of them in my short segment here, I wanted to make sure you had enough information to be comfortable with responding. This first proposed rule is HUD's Fair Lending Proposed Rule. The term they're using is implementation of the Fair Housing Act's discriminatory effects standard. The comments are due by January 17th. Don't think you've got plenty of time to respond because you know what's going to happen. The holidays are going to come up, or the other part of the holidays, and we're going to have all kinds of interruptions during the month of December. So start taking a look at where your company stands today. The concept behind this discriminatory effects standards is that term disparate impact. We have used this for years. We have had to teach this, help companies understand it for years. And what policies might a bank or lending institution have that could pose a disparate impact on a particular group of individuals? One real basic example that sometimes you can, we had one bank that was considering was the idea of having a minimum cost to obtain a loan. So if I were to say to you, Bank A has a minimum fee of $10,000, I'm sorry, let me rephrase, has a minimum down payment, let's use that example, has a minimum down payment of $10,000 on every single loan. They're not using a loan-to-value percentage standard, they're using a minimum dollar amount for down payments. Then that would mean a borrower with a $50,000 home interested in purchasing a $50,000 home would have to put $10,000 down as a minimum down payment, just like a $250,000 purchase price would have to have a minimum of a $10,000 down payment. Now, you can see in that example how that policy could have a disparate impact on those lower price range homes. in that example, you end up with, maybe it's not intentional by the bank, they don't actually have the intention of discriminating, but the policy itself is causing that. So there's this very large discussion when we talk about, is that a violation of fair lending, that in some cases a policy can be, perhaps it can be a neutral policy or it can be something that wasn't intentionally set, but the end result is disparate impact. And so how you interpret this law or how you interpret what is disparate has been treated differently by the courts. This proposed rule is trying to set one standard. The proposed rule is trying to adopt a three-step burden-shifting approach to determine the liability, because it's always, all right, does the lender have to prove that this $10,000 down payment requirement isn't affecting anybody negatively or a protected class negatively, or is it affecting? Is it the defendant or the borrowers who feel that they're being treated unfairly for having to have larger down payments? Are they the ones who have to have the burden of proof? So there's always been in the courts this shifting burden of proof on both sides, and I won't get into all that detail here on today's short segment, but I do want you to go take a look at it. Take a look at your banking policies and look historically at the history that's in this proposed rule and make sure at your entity, how would this impact you? How could this potential change of this three-step approach potentially make it tougher for plaintiffs to defend themselves in the event that they're being accused of disparate impact? Because obviously the bank's usually sitting on the plaintiff side of these as someone is making a case that they're not treating borrowers fairly or that they have a policy that's creating a disparate impact. The comment period, like I said, is due by January 17th, 2012, and you'll want to make sure that you understand that HUD is trying to now set one policy, which, in a sense, would that override previous courts' opinions or not? I'm not a lawyer. We'll have to check with the lawyers on that one. Another rule, the Volcker rule, the comment period is open until January 12th. This is proposing to implement Section 619 of the Dodd-Frank Act, which would have certain prohibitions and restrictions on the ability of a banking entity and non-bank financial companies supervised by the board to engage in proprietary training and have certain interests in or relationships with a hedge fund or private equity fund. So it would set up prohibitions for those types of relationships with those entities. So you do want to check out both of those proposed rules because those are the ones that are open right now. One last thing from a date standpoint, because I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk to Glenn and Pete, is we have a new policy under FHA. FHA announced on November 8th that they have a new condominium reviewer registry. So all of you FHA lenders out there, if you have your own DELRAP, DE, lender approval processing approach for condominiums under FHAs, you've got to get those individual registered. You've got to treat it just like DE underwriting, where you can't just have anybody do part of the process to review a condo. I know some companies have triaged this process, like you might have an administrative person who knows how to run through a master deed and bylaws and make sure that all the legal wording is correct. And you may have someone else who's trained to look at insurance. You've got to have now these reviewers are registered with an ID number, go into FHA Connection, check out the condominium registry. FHA has extended the deadline. You have until December 5th to get your people registered. This is quick. You've got to jump on it because you have really only about a week to get this done. So that's the legislative update for November 28th, 2011. Coming up next, we're going to have the Profit Doctor, Andy Schell. Anxiously awaiting to see what analogy or story he comes up with today. Maybe it's one of Aesop's fables. I don't know. But we'll be right back after this brief message.
Looking for a full-service mortgage training and consulting company to fit exactly what you need? Mortgage U is your ultimate education and information resource used by lenders to execute high-impact, high-quality training throughout the organization. Mortgage U instructors are mortgage professionals,
providing classroom and web-based delivery,
and has the most sought-after training manuals in the country. Mortgage U has a proven track record, performing customized training programs for hundreds and even thousands of employees, both live and online.
time on everything from application through loan delivery and insuring. Call Mortgage U today at 800-278-0200 or visit us online at mortgage-u.com. Welcome back to Lickin' on Lending. Our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here's David Lickin.
Welcome back, everyone. And it is my pleasure to introduce Andy Schell, the Profit Doctor. Andy, are you out there?
Hey, Alice.
Oh, yes, there yes. you go. You've been awfully quiet up until now. So I'm going to give you the floor and tell us what's up with the Profit Doctor today.
Well, thank
you. Did you have a nice Thanksgiving?
I'm still recovering from Thanksgiving a bit, I think. And
yeah.
I didn't come up with anything as creative as an Aesop's fable this time. But I do have a little bit of a connection to Christmas. You know, I always think about whether if it's Thanksgiving or Christmas is how much is enough. You know, how much turkey is enough? How much pecan pie is too much? So these are always important decisions that I face twice a year. And you know, another side of how much is enough is that now that we're past Thanksgiving and we're on the downhill slide to Christmas, you know, one of the reasons I really enjoy Christmas is I like watching my kids open their presents. That's always fun. And as a parent, the question of how many presents is enough is often a topic of conversation. You know, how much you go to Toys R Us and you buy the whole aisle and there has to be established, or you have to have some basis for how much is enough for a lot of reasons. You know, you don't want to spoil the kids. On the other hand, also, you don't want to spend your mortgage payment on presents. You want to be able to make your car payment in January.
Well, is it quality or quantity, right?
Exactly. Well, and these same kind of decisions, I think, are important to consider, and how much is enough? And we face these kind of questions in our business as well. You know, how much volume is enough? How much revenue is enough? And or better yet, how much profit is enough? And I can tell you I've talked to a lot of mortgage bankers, and I don't think I've ever talked to anyone who says that there's enough volume. Everybody wants more volume. But the thing about it is any company must make profit to survive. It's not just volume, it's profit. And every company has to understand their formula for profit. You know, and there's a lot of dynamics that come into this. So one simple way to look at it is the formula for profit in mortgage banking is the right combination of volume, margin, which drives revenue, and then expense. So by looking at those four things, and if we think about it, if you have more volume with lower margin, that can make the same revenue as lower volume but higher margin, because they all
right.
work inversely, right? But the problem is the other dynamic is higher volume also will almost always mean higher expense, and you end up with lower margin. But the point is you've got to understand your profit. You've got to understand the dynamics that drive profit. And so I think the best place to start is to thoroughly understand the relationship between all these variables and have the ability to model the dynamics so you can at the very least understand break-even. And then once you understand break-even, you need to then calculate and confirm how much you need to make the kind of return you want to get. Because in an investment, in a business, how much is enough is driven by return on investment, or ROI. ROI drives the decision of how much is enough, because investors look at alternatives. They can get X percent invested here or X percent invested there. So we need to know our ROI. So what is the ROI of the listeners' mortgage companies during 2011? We're close enough to the end of the year to be able to forecast what December is going to be, and we ought to know what was our ROI for 2011, and is that enough? Was the return that you expected to get what you actually got, and was the return that you actually got what you thought was enough? And if not, what are you going to do about it to make it be more? I've yet to have any clients tell me their ROI was too low. But, you know, and we have clients that have pre-tax ROIs in the 30, 40, 50% return on investment range. I mean, we work with a lot of companies around the country, and many of them are doing really well and having a very, very significant ROI. And one of the things that's consistent among the companies that do have an ROI, a strong ROI, is they know what it is, and they have the ability to calculate it.
Do you find the companies find a sweet spot and then automatically want to get to the next level? Or, are there companies that really recognize this is my sweet spot and I'm going to just stay here? Or is that impossible?
Well, no, that's a great question. And the companies that we work with that are really doing very, very well understand that you can't be all things to all people, and being bigger is not necessarily better, because to go to the next level of additional branches or whatever it is could add another level of complexity in systems. There's all kinds of dynamics that come into play. You think you're pushing a button and a drawer pops out, and you push the drawer in and the light turns on. I mean, there's all these connections and wires behind the walls that you need to understand and model to know what the dynamics are and how it's going to affect your business to go to the next step. So as we talk about mortgage banking, though, just a couple other points about the theory behind creating an effective company. And just back to basic, just some very basic points about what it means to run an effective company. And think about it. I know you do this, Alice, in your consulting work. Think about mortgage banking as a loan factory. You know, it's a loan factory, and so our goal in running a mortgage bank is to quickly move applications through the process to become a loan, and that loan's purchased by the investor, and we want to have as few people as possible touching the information, and we want to accomplish this perfectly every time with no errors, and we only want the people to touch the applications that become loans. You know, if you do that, that's a perfect mortgage bank.
Right,
The challenge is managing all those dynamics to fit into the most optimal structure. And, you know, how do we do that? Well, there's a couple of quick things, and we've talked about this in the past, but it's the three E's and the three R's. It's efficient, effective, and economic. So efficient means quickly producing results, don't waste any time, and effective is activity that is correct every time. You want it for it to be fast and correct. And then economic, obviously, is we want for it to cost less than the revenue that it generated. So there's a balance there. And then the three R's are having the right people doing the right things at the right time. Now, we've gone into companies and just talked about these two concepts, effective, efficient, economic, and right people, right things, right time. And just doing that applied across an organization can drive profitability, and that helps to drive the ROI. But, you know, there's more to it than that, and so that's a little theoretical. So here's a little bit more kind of boots-on-the-ground perspective on how to deal with some of this. And so one of the things that I like to do is come up with these five segments. It's called Vision, Measure, Optimize, Report, and Grow. Vision, Measure, Optimize, Report, and Grow. So vision is having a plan. Know where you're going to go. Have a financial forecast that's going to predict your profit and predict your ROI, so you have a goal of where you're going to go. And then as you're going, you have to measure. You have to capture loan-level data for every loan and be able to accumulate the operational details to produce KPIs. And then
right. If
you're doing that, you can then optimize. So you want to have the best technology, the best process flow. I know, Alice, you do a lot of work in helping people decide and enhance their process flow. And you need to have systems and technology that generate efficiency. And it's not about having the cheapest system. We have people call all the time and want us to give opinions about various systems. Well, it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. It's all about ROI. It's not the cheapest. It's about the ROI in technology investments. And then beyond optimize, you need to report. You need to know if you're making a profit. You need to know what your profit per loan is and your profit per originator, and have the systems to put all this in place and work correctly together. And then, after all this is set, the vision, measure, optimize, report, then you can grow. Add more branches, get more capital, acquire more companies, always watching the ROI. And so as I wrap up here in the next 20 seconds, I want to close with one thing, and this closes an analogy. It's not an Aesop's fable, but it's an analogy from the movie Field of Dreams. Everybody remembers the movie Field of Dreams. Kevin Costner turned the cornfield into a baseball diamond. And if you remember the line in the movie, it's, if you build it, they will come. Well, in the movie, the ROI for mowing down the cornfield, which mowing down corn, that's a productive asset that you're eliminating. So, but the ROI was a restored relationship with his father. And then you saw all the cars lining up to come pay to see the baseball diamond. So they replaced the ROI. They replaced the revenue to generate their ROI by all these cars coming. But generally in business, here's the point. Field of Dreams is a bad idea. Don't build it and hope they will come when you're building a business. Grow your revenue. Grow your expenses as your revenue supports the growth. So add expense as you're adding revenue. Add revenue, add expense, add revenue as expense. So don't spend in front of revenue. Generate revenue, add expense. Generate revenue, add expense. And a lot of that can be done by a couple of different techniques that we can help people deploy. But it's generally best, make more money, spend more money, make more money, spend more money.
Right.
Don't spend a bunch and hope you're going to make more.
Well, that's great advice, Andy. Absolutely great advice. You know, I think the devil in all those details in the vision, measure, optimize, report, and grow is we feel like we've got this extra layer of scrutiny on the audit side. You know, when you look in even some of the things I know Glenn may have some time to touch on is just the way the state auditors now have this, you know, 250-page manual for auditing loan officer compensation. So in all of that is staying in compliance at the same time. That's great advice. Generate revenue, then add expense. Any closing remarks?
No, thanks. Thanks, Alice. The world of mortgage banking is going to become much more dependent upon technology, compliance, and finance. It's just the reality of what we're going to be facing. And I can't wait to hear what Glenn and the team there have to say.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Andy. Great as always. That was Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions. Stick around, everybody. Up next, we have Glenn Corso, Managing Director of the Community Mortgage Banking Project, and Pete Mills, his partner. They will be on speaking with us about the future of independent mortgage banking. We will be right back in 60 seconds.
Mortgage Banking Solutions is the preeminent management consulting firm to the residential mortgage lending industry. No other firm in the U.S. offers the menu of services or the level of expertise to the industry.
If you're looking for help converting from best efforts to hedging, or need help with bookkeeping to know your profit per loan,
if you are interested in making the transition from broker to banker, or if you just need a roadmap for success,
Mortgage Banking Solutions' primary focus is to enable executives to take their business to the next level and guide them down a path towards success and profitability. With over 300 combined years of experience in all facets of mortgage lending, the Mortgage Banking Solutions team of professionals has the expertise and know-how to help you accomplish your goals. New warehouse lines of credit,
broker to banker transitions, transitioning to hedging, financial and accounting services, or meeting your capitalization needs.
If you need help with these or any other aspects of your business, please contact our Mortgage Banking Solutions sales team to see how we can help you at 512-977-9900. That's 512-977-9900. Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Alice Alvey filling in for Dave Licken as Dave is traveling back from his Thanksgiving holiday. I would like to welcome to the program Glenn Corso, Managing Director of the Community Mortgage Banking Project, and Pete Mills, his partner. Do we have both of you on the line? Glenn, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Welcome. And Pete.
I am here as well.
Great. Great to have both of you on the program. I know that you have really been in the thick of things these days, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about what do we have in store for us, the future of the independent mortgage banker today. You know, we've done well for many, many years in this industry, and we've really contributed good things to the mortgage market. But I'd like to ask you, where do you think the future is headed?
Well, Alice, that is really the big question, isn't it? In 60 seconds or less, right? Well, here's the thing. I mean, the basics of mortgage banking and the basics for the independents have been for years and years now, really originating high quality mortgages that are sought after for two reasons. Number one, because in securitized form in particular, they're a good investment for long-term investors. Then number two, of course, the right to service those loans has also become a really sought-after asset as well. And once servicing became the accounting treatment of servicing rights changed so that they became an asset that companies could actually put on their balance sheet, then all of a sudden you started to see the growth of the mega servicers, good prices or big prices for mortgage servicing rights, and many independents switched to largely originating loans for sale, servicing released. Now, there's changes in the works, though, and the changes are coming from several different directions, and I'm going to toss it over to my partner, Pete, in a second to talk about a couple of those. But those changes are going to mean that the old model of originate to sell everything, servicing released, probably is going to become harder to sustain in the future than it is today. And we both think that most independent mortgage bankers should be seriously considering retaining at least a portion of the servicing rights on the loans that they're originating today, whether they set up their own servicing operation or they decide to subservice. That's a business decision that has many different factors to it.
Sure.
But the idea behind being able to run into the indefinite future an operation where you just sell everything servicing released, I think is going to become much more difficult in the future. So let me turn to my partner Pete for a second now, and he can give us a quick rundown on a couple of the items that we think are going to start to push things in the direction I'm indicating. Pete?
There are two sort of key changes in the regulatory sphere that are going to drive change. The first is the Basel III capital treatment. Basel III is the international capital framework that all the major banks, both foreign banks and domestic banks, are going to be held to over the coming. They have a phase-in period of 5 years. And over the next 5 years, U.S. banks are going to be trying to meet these capital requirements and in the process managing their balance sheets towards those new requirements. One of the changes in the Basel III requirements is a change to the way mortgage servicing rights are treated in terms of how they count towards the bank's core capital requirements. And those changes essentially limit the amount of MSRs that the banks can count towards their capital requirements. And as a result, some of the larger mega servicers face some limitations that will be expensive from a capital requirement, from a capital standards requirement to those banks. And it either require them to shrink their servicing portfolios or raise capital in order to support them. And that's going to be – it's already driving change, we think. We think it's one of the factors that's depressing what the big aggregators are paying for servicing today. The second big issue on the horizon, and it's somewhat related to the Basel III issue, is the Federal Housing Finance Agency, as the conservator for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, is seeking to change the compensation structure for servicing. Currently, there's a 25 basis point strip minimum servicing fee that's required, and they are looking at a couple of different proposals to change that. The objectives here are to some of the driver is coming out of the problems that they faced over the past couple of years with the large servicers not being able to execute on their loss mitigation strategies. And the GSEs feel that there's a misalignment of interests between the servicers, the borrowers, and the investors. So they're trying to address that. They're trying to address the issue that the mega banks are facing with respect to their capital requirements driven by Basel III. And they also are trying to encourage smaller servicers to retain servicing. Those are three objectives. The proposals that they put on the table don't necessarily meet them with equal force. But the proposals that they are changing, they're proposing, would essentially take the modest proposal would take the minimum servicing fee and essentially require a portion of the servicing fee to be set aside as a reserve, and we call that the reserve model. There are a couple of different options out there. One proposed by MBA would reduce the servicing fee to 20 basis points with a 5 basis point reserve. Another organization called the Clearinghouse Association, which represents largely the money center banks, is proposing a 1/8 servicing fee with a 2 to 3 basis point reserve. And then the second model out there is what they call fee for service, and that essentially, Glenn, do you want to walk through the full fee for service model?
Yeah, I'd like to. I know we have Joe Farr and Andy Schell on the line, both very knowledgeable on the site as well, and I know we want to talk about that fee for service. So, Glenn, give us a little background on that.
Okay.
Yeah. Let me give it some quick background, and then Joe and Andy, please jump in. Essentially, what the fee for service proposal is it kind of in one sense turns the mortgage servicing relationship almost upside down By that I mean that right now, as everyone knows, if you're servicing loans for the GSEs, you're responsible for collecting the payments from the borrowers. Then you, out of those payments, you retain your monthly servicing fee. You remit to the GSEs their portion, their guarantee fee, whatever it is that, that you're paying them for that. And then, of course, the balance goes to the investors in terms of principal and interest on the securities that the loans are placed in. And, of course, you also have the amounts that the borrowers are paying you for escrow, for property tax, homeowners insurance, et cetera, private mortgage insurance, and the rest. And that, of course, gets put into the various escrow accounts and then paid out to those providers as the bills come due. In this fee-for-service proposal, what would happen is that you as the servicer would collect the payment. You would then turn around and pay 8 basis points to the GSEs, whichever GSE is the guarantor, as the master servicing fee. You would then, in addition, pay them their guarantee fee, and then, of course, the principal and interest gets remitted to the investors, and the amounts representing escrow goes into the various escrow accounts. Out of that 8 basis points that you pay to the GSE, they in turn would pay you $10 per performing loan per month, and that would be your, quote, servicing fee. So you, instead of taking your money up front and instead of really being able to manage your business with the servicing fee as you see fit, you instead become a fee-for-service contractor to the GSEs.
Right.
So that in a nutshell is what that proposal is. As you can see, that would have a pretty significant impact on the value of mortgage servicing rights, since the right to get paid $10 per performing loan per month and meanwhile still have to do all those myriad of responsibilities that servicers are required to do, including advancing principal and interest and making up for interest curtailments, et cetera, all those are still the responsibilities of the servicer, but now they're doing that for a lot less money.
Joe, why don't you jump in here with some of the questions I know you had on our pre-call.
Yeah, well, Glenn, a couple questions, and Pete, the if the value of servicing or the revenue from servicing is going to go down, its value is going to go down, as we've discussed. Going back to one of the things you had suggested early on about independent mortgage bankers retaining some servicing rights, is there a point at which this, like if it goes fee-for-service route, that you'd change that recommendation, or is there still value in retaining some of that in your mind?
Well, Joe, to be honest with you, it's sort of a devil in the deep blue sea kind of choice, if you want to know the truth. The reason being that you're correct in pointing out that the act of servicing becomes a lot less profitable under that scenario. However, at the same time, your alternative is to sell the loan servicing released, and of course, because the activity of servicing is generating a lot less income, that means that you're going to get quite a lower price for that servicing strip when you sell a loan servicing released. So it's almost as if it's a heads or tails, you lose both
right.
ways kind of proposition.
Well, one follow-up question to that is, let's take a loan where it's currently a 4.5% loan, and the current mechanics are that a quarter goes to pay the GSEs a guarantee fee and a quarter goes to servicing, and 4% goes to the investor. If the portion going to servicing is reduced to this 8 basis points or whatever, what happens to the rest of that quarter, and is that more premium the mortgage banker can sell?
That is more premium that the mortgage banker can sell. The question really becomes how much do they get paid for that? Is the multiple that they get paid for it the equivalent of the multiple that they're getting for that strip right now
right.
when it's part of servicing? And also then, the other big thing is that right now you sell that as part of the servicing fee, you know, the difference between 8 and the 25 minimum that there is today, so 17 basis points. That, of course, carries a tax advantage with it because if it's part of the servicing fee and there's a safe harbor in the tax treatment, then you don't get taxed on that money until you actually receive the income. If that were disassociated from the servicing fee, then as soon as you book that as an asset, it becomes taxable income. And so you're paying tax in advance of actually receiving the cash, which, of course, makes it a tax-disadvantaged asset, and hence it commands a lower price in the marketplace.
That's incredibly, you know, it really is a full analysis that companies have to sit down right now and see which end of this is going to make the most sense for them. Andy, do you have anything you want to ask Glenn at this point?
Yeah, I do, actually. I was just making a couple of notes here. You know, the SRP MSR tax treatment issue, that's not new, but it's certainly something that needs to be considered when everyone's in analyzing this issue, and it's complicated, and it's not going to be less complicated going forward. But it does sound like under any case, the SRP is going to go down some, even if the excess premium is still recaptured by the mortgage banker. There's still 8 basis points more going to the GSEs, either way you look at it. So there's going to be a financial consequence to mortgage bankers because of this. And I don't hear in the conferences talk about this as much of a high priority as I think that people need to be, because it is going to affect mortgage bankers, whether if you retain or release. Either way you look at it, there's going to be a cash flow impact from this. And so given that, do you guys have a perspective on which way the pendulum is swinging between the reserve model or the fee-for-service model at this point?
Yeah, this is Pete. First of all, I would encourage everybody to read the paper. It's an options paper that's been put out by the FHFA on their website. I would encourage everybody to read through it. We would say that based upon first of all, I would say preface this by saying we think some change will be made, whether they go a modest change or which is closer to the reserve account proposal, or a radical change. We think one way or the other that the regulator is committed to making a change. And I think our handicapping of that change right now tells us they are, and if you read the paper, you'll see they expend an extraordinary amount of time trying to talk up the fee-for-service model. And so I think the challenge for the industry is to, A, figure out the impact on your companies and where you want to be on this. And then secondly, if you see the concerns that we have with the fee-for-service model, we would encourage folks to comment. There is a comment period which ends the end of December. I don't know what the exact date is, Glenn. Is it the 29th?
I think it's December 26th, the day after Christmas.
So there is a comment deadline. We would encourage folks to comment. The Community Mortgage Banking Project will be submitting a comment letter. And we'd be happy to share that with your folks, with your audience, to help them formulate their own comments, if that's helpful.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is very helpful because a lot of people do need that extra, you know, guidance. They know that it's, you know, important. It's going to hit their bottom line, but you're going to articulate it in just the right way that it gets the point across right. Andy?
Okay.
No, that's great. Thanks, Pete. And Alice, that the fact that something's going to happen, and the fact that something's going to happen is going to affect our bottom lines, is something that I think the industry as a whole needs to get jumping up and down about. We need to start talking about it more and more. And I know Pete and Glenn, you guys are, and I guess some of the other groups as well are. But this just isn't a topic that I see. I don't hear people talking about this in conferences, and that they need to be, because this is going to. We don't want to be surprised again by something new landing on us and us not being prepared.
Well, and especially I think because it's so complex, that's why it really needs to. People need to hear it many, many times. Joe, were you going to jump in?
Yeah, I was going to say that the reality is the customer is going to wind up paying for this because everyone's going to have to factor in what they get for the single asset or the two assets that they have to sell, both the loan and the servicing. And if that price goes down, then they're going to have to charge the customer more.
That's right. Could be an impact to rates. Well, let's take a break, quick break right here, and I have one more commercial that we need to fit in, and we'll be right back after this brief word.
In today's climate, quality counts more than ever, and Wetzel's Trot can help your company maintain the quality that you require to survive in an ever-changing market. With over 450 customers across the country, Wetzel's Trot has specialized in quality control reviews for residential lenders since 1985. Wetzel's Trot can assist your organization in maintaining a high standard of quality within your residential mortgage operation. They offer a wide variety of services, including loan quality control, servicing quality control, quality control plans, fraud review services, and even web-based quality control software. Quality is never an accident. It is always the result of high intention, sincere effort, intelligent direction, and skillful execution. Choosing Wetzel's Trot represents the wise choice of many alternatives. Contact Wetzel's Trot today for details at 248-592-2252. Wetzel's Trot, the single source solution for your quality control needs.
And now, broadcasting live from Austin, Texas, we're back with the Lincoln on Lending Show.
Welcome back to the Lincoln on Lending program. We are speaking with Glenn Corso and Pete Mills from the Community Mortgage Banking Project. We also have Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline and Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions with us. So, let's continue our previous discussion. In addition to the minimum servicing fee issues, I know that the Community Mortgage Banking Project is working on a couple other major issues that are of critical importance. You had mentioned guarantee fee parity and, of course, QRM. So, Glenn, I guess I'm going to take it back to you and have you start these next 2 points that we need to make sure our listeners are aware of.
Very good, Alice. And Alice, if you wouldn't mind, I will spend the next 5 seconds or so just reminding your listeners what the Community Mortgage Banking Project is.
Perfect.
If that's okay. Wonderful.
Absolutely.
So Pete and I head up a public policy group called the Community Mortgage Banking Project. We have 45 independent mortgage banking companies that have joined together with us in the Community Mortgage Banking Project. We represent the view of independent mortgage bankers on public policy issues here in D.C. and with the states for the National Mortgage Licensing System. So we're very active with Congress on various mortgage issues. We deal with the regulatory agencies. Obviously, as you can hear, we're talking about Basel III and the GSE minimum servicing fee standards. We are also very active on issues with NMLS. So for our independent mortgage banking companies that we work with, the whole idea between how their loan officers have to be licensed while bank loan officers only have to be registered, and the difficulty for independent mortgage bankers in recruiting bank loan officers to come to work for them because the bank loan officers, of course, haven't gone through the NMLS licensing process and have to do that before they can be hired and be productive for the companies. That's the kinds of things that we work on behalf of the lenders we work with.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about the guarantee fee parity issue that you're working on?
Sure. So one of the things that and there was a very recent report on this, and it's really quite fascinating. You know, the GSEs have been in conservatorship since 2008. Now, before they went into conservatorship, I think it was very well known all throughout the industry that the GSEs commonly would give a big discount in their guarantee fee to lenders based upon the volume of loans that lenders delivered to them. So,
yeah,
instance,
that was a good arm wrestling negotiation going on.
Absolutely. So, you know, the big guys pre 2008, Countrywide, Washington Mutual, IndyMac, etc., as well as the names we're still familiar with, Bank America and Wells Fargo, all got very big breaks on their guarantee fees because of the huge volume of loans that they delivered to the GSEs. Then the GSEs went into conservatorship in September of 2008. And, you know, if you were an outside observer, you'd be perfectly justified in thinking, well, those big volume discounts must have gone out the window, right? They're under government control now, so they're not competing with each other for market share. Well, guess what? That's not the case. They, in fact, still continue to give a break on the guarantee fee to the big lenders that deliver them the most volume. So Wells Fargo and Bank America and Chase all have much lower guarantee fees than your average, mom and pop independent mortgage banker operating out of Topeka, Kansas. And so that's one of the issues we've been working on with the FHFA, pointing out that what was really a technique, I guess is the best way to put it, by the GSEs to sort of one-up each other in their fight for market share should, 3 years after they've been in conservatorship, no longer be a fixture in what they're doing. And the FHFA has been listening to us, making favorable noises about making that change. Ed DeMarco, the director of the FHFA, talked about that issue back in September when he appeared in front of a North Carolina bankers conference and talked about how they were going to do away with it. Of course, we haven't seen that yet, but at least we think we have them moving in the right direction on that score.
Hey,
so
Glenn,
it
real
sounds
quick.
Like at least they're listening. Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, how big a difference are you? Have you seen, like, how low are the big guys versus? I guess I always use 25 as sort of the average.
Well, Joe, it's difficult to say. Two things that Pete and I have learned on this. Number one is that no matter what the size is of the mortgage banker that you talk to, he or she is always convinced that they have a better guarantee fee than everybody else. So, you know, no matter what, they'll never admit, oh, yeah, I have a terrible guarantee fee, and I know it. The second thing, though, is that the FHFA came out, they're mandated by law to come out with an annual report. And they came out with their report in October that talks specifically about the differences in the guarantee fees. And Pete is a real expert in that report, so I'm going to toss it to him to give you the results, and that'll more fully answer your question.
What the FHFA did in their analysis is to break lenders into three groups by the volume of loans sold to the GSEs. And this is aggregated across both GSEs, so it's a little hard to It's a little opaque, but what they did is they took the 10 largest sellers by volume and calculated an average G fee for those 10. They took the next 90, so that's numbers 11 through 100, calculated a G fee for them, and then they took 101 and above and calculated an average G fee for the smallest lenders. And in the most recent study, which is of 2010 data, the spread between the 10 largest and numbers 101 and above is 8 basis points. That's down from 9 basis points the previous year, but it was 8 basis points in 2008. So there's not much of a trend. While the GSEs are telling us that they think the trend is down, we don't think a move from 8 to 9 to 8 is exactly a trend just yet. So we continue to pressure the FHFA. We've been talking to Congress about the need for a requirement that the GSEs have a uniform G fee across all lenders. The real principle we're arguing for is that if you have the same loan made by two different lenders, as long as they're both eligible sellers, they should get the same G fee. If you look at the report, FHFA provides a number of reasons why the G fees are lower for the largest lenders, but really what it comes down to is bigger is better. They highlight two factors. One is that the largest lenders contribute to the overall liquidity, enhance the overall liquidity of the GSE securities, therefore they get a better G fee, which we think sums up to bigger is better. The second factor is what they call negotiating leverage, which is, again, the larger lenders, through their volume commitments, are able to get lower G fees. So the current spread between the largest and the smallest is about 9 basis points, 8 to 9 basis points on average. We think if you compared it to the top three or four, that spread would widen a little bit further.
Thank
well,
you.
It's good to hear that you're making some progress and that they're listening to the side of, you know, the independent mortgage banker. We're down to just a couple of minutes here. I'd like to make sure we get a minute to just touch on QRM and describe how this regulation is, where this stands today. Glenn, is there any movement on that at all, or can we just hope that it falls away and somebody buries it in a closet somewhere?
This is Pete. As everybody knows, the comment deadline has closed on the QRM regulation, and we continue to try to get the media and the regulators focused on the data, which is what should drive this decision. At the current moment, we understand that the regulators are meeting fairly regularly. There were 10,000 comments submitted. If you weeded out the form letters, there's close to 1,000 comments, many of them with lots of data and support for their position. And you've got six regulators that are trying to wade through these. So it is going to take some time. We understand that the QM regulation, which is the ability to pay rule, will come out first. And that's important because the QRM, which is the risk retention rule, the QRM can be defined no more broadly than the QM. And so what we will get in this, by the slowdown in the QRM regulation, we'll be able to see just what they're planning to do on the qualified mortgage rules for the ability to pay standard. And then from that, we can begin to look at how we size the QRM for risk retention. And our hope is that those two definitions will be as close to one another as possible. And so if we targeted February for the QM, I think it would be some months later before the QRM rule was finalized. And the last point I'll make is that there is a possibility they could, there are so many complex issues in the QRM rule that they may actually repropose it.
Oh, and that was going to be my question. You know, are these new proposals we're going to see at that time or really final rules and no time left for any kind of change? So, well, thank you
so
much.
We think the ability to pay rule will be a final rule. But the QRM, there is a possibility they could repropose it.
All right. Sounds great. Well, thank you both so much, Glenn and Pete. How can people get in touch with you? Glenn?
So our website address is communitymbmarybaker.com, and then my email is Glenn, G-L-E-N, at mortgagepolicy.org, and Pete's is Pete at mortgagepolicy.org.
Great. Thank you so much for your time today. It is very valuable. We'd love to have you back to talk more about issues related to CSBS and ARMOR and the state compliance issues, GSE housing finance reform. There's lots to talk about. So thank you again so much for your time. Joe, do you have anything you want to mention here? We have just a couple minutes left.
Yeah, as I said to start the show, expect favorable repricing. And while we've been on, we have seen a number of investors favorably reprice. So I hope you were able to wait to lock and take advantage of that.
Awesome. Great advice. Andy, how about you?
Well, yeah, it's a good conversation. There's things are going to happen in service fees. We know that. So when it does, we just need to remember change is coming again and model the variables. Don't guess about the numbers. Get the facts, and we'll all sort this out.
Great. Thank you. I'd like to thank everyone for being here today. Join us next week and every Monday. We are live at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And for those of you who want to hear the Lickin' on Lending show live, don't forget to subscribe to our show via iTunes or right here at blogtalkradio.com. Have a great week. I am Alice Alvey, and thank you all for being here. Have a great day.
This has been Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.